I'm Andrew.
And I'm Spencer. And you're listening to the At a Distance podcast from The Slowdown. Today, we'll be speaking with Joseph Awa Darko, the founder and president of the Institute Museum of Ghana and director of the Noldor Residency, an annual four-week program inviting an emerging African artist with limited access to resources to expand on their practice in a studio space and retreat in Accra.
As an entrepreneur, art collector, and an artist, Joseph is among Ghana's leading voices in contemporary art, helping build the West African nation's cultural contributions globally.
Before we get into the episode, we'd first like to thank our sponsor, the Japanese luxury timepiece manufacturer Grand Seiko, which brings an incredible level of craft and detail to every watch it makes. From its founding, Grand Seiko has sought to create the world's most durable and beautiful watches with the highest accuracy and legibility possible. The new SBGW279, a U.S. exclusive from the Elegance Collection, follows in this tradition, pulling cues directly from the very first Grand Seiko, which dates back to 1960.
As with so many of Grand Seiko's timepieces, nature is central to the watch's design. Inspired by the Oruri songbird that migrates from Southeast Asia to the mountainous regions of Japan during Rika, the seasonal phase that marks the start of summer, the blue dial of the SBGW279 is finished in an eye-catching sunray pattern. Assembled by the highly skilled craftspeople of Grand Seiko's Shizuku Ishii Watch Studio, the watch is polished throughout with a distortion-free mirror finish, and its box-shaped sapphire crystal evokes the look of a vintage watch.
To learn more about the SBGW279 or Grand Seiko's other distinctive timepieces, head to www.grand-seiko.com. And now, here's our conversation with Joseph Awa Darko. Hi, Joseph. Welcome to At a Distance. It's so great to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it and looking forward to getting into it.
So you turned 26 years old last week and you've had a lot to celebrate. You wrote on Twitter this really meaningful tweet to you and I'm sure to your followers and those who know what you've been doing, which was dropped out of college after suicide attempt in 2017, reapplied in 2020 during the COVID-19 pandemic, built a $1 million organization which supports African contemporary artists in 2021 while studying online, graduated a Shesi in 2022. Amazing.
Yes, all those things are true. I think for me, it was just about normalizing the, I guess, struggle and adversity and reality of how I got to where I am now. I thought it was just important to share that.
Well, and I wanted to pause quickly here at the beginning just to note that you did all this in the midst of the pandemic. You launched both the Institute Museum of Ghana, which is Ghana's first contemporary art museum, and the Noldor Residency, which is Ghana's first independent arts residency and fellowship program. Could you talk a little bit about both these projects? What are your visions for these and how do they connect?
I basically have been in the contemporary art world for the past 7 years. And having experienced, like most of us, as I call it, COVID aloka, or in this case, COVID, I realized that there was a situation globally that was sort of like a exacerbation of resources and support for emerging contemporary artists within the subculture, especially in Ghana. So I went back on a very dramatic COVID repatriation flight from London to Accra during the pandemic and then decided that I would be much less passively involved in artist careers as a collector, but also be more proactively involved through running a residency program. Now, the reason why I didn't choose to do a gallery is because I mean, even though I have many friends who run amazing gallery programs, such as, you know, Ada Contemporary in Ghana or Leeson Gallery in London that, you know, my friends the Logsdales have, I think I've always had a very personal relationship with the artists I collect. And I think a residency program felt like a much less distilled and much more nurturing and engaging environment to build and support talent. And so I founded the Nodal Artist Residency in November of 2020 with our inaugural artist in residence, Emmanuel Taku. And it's funny, you know, I've been an artist myself, and actually am an artist practicing at the same time. And so I think the unique beauty of Noldor as a residency and fellowship program is that it is instinctively an artist-led space. Even our chief curator, Rita Bedison, who graduated with an MFA in Wisconsin, moved to Ghana for the role of being chief curator, and she's also an artist herself. And so I think that it was the perfect situation to sort of start a really dynamic program that supported artists from Ghana, from within the continent and the diaspora. And as far as the museum program, I mean, for a long time, you know, I've been collecting for the past 5 years as well, from emerging to mid-career to some established artists. Artists like Abdoulaye Konaté, Serge Atukwe-Clote, Ibrahim El-Salahi, Salah El-Mir, the range, you know, from more emerging artists like Zandile Shabalala, who's South African, and the list goes on, right? But I decided that really I wanted to evolve in my role and from the success of the residency with our inaugural artist in residency, Emmanuel Taku, to now pledging a body of my own work collected over time to the institution and setting foot in my purpose in navigating Ghana's soft power. I think that was important. And I was really inspired by a visit that Kehinde Wiley made to our space, which we had done with the support of the Ministry of Tourism, Arts and Culture at the Creative Arts Council. And when he came, I think, you know, he was really excited about this new sense of energy and this sort of renaissance that is sort of happening as far as the creative proliferation and cultural proliferation in Ghana. And it's just been exciting to sort of be a part of that and at the center of that. And I thought this was the right time.
You identified soft power as this strong tool. So I was hoping you might just elaborate a little bit on that, this idea, art as a tool for soft power and how to move culture through that and why you chose art, I guess, other than the collecting.
Well, I think I've always been a creative multi-hyphenate. I've been an artist and continue to be so. I've been a contemporary art advisor. I've been on the boards of contemporary art institutions. I've been at the forefront of the really important and significant impact that art can have on a cultural level. Beyond my friendships with other thought leaders in the contemporary art world, you know, like Hans Overlich, who's the director of the Serpentine, or Anne Pasternak, who's the director of the Brooklyn Museum, or I've had a unique view of the ability of the arts to push culture forward. I think for me, referring to the fact that, you know, Kehinde Wiley, who painted Barack Obama's national portrait, was able to come and visit our space in Accra with the support of the Ministry of Tourism, Arts and Culture, and to interact with the artists in residence and the fellows. Moments like that where there is cross-pollination, you know, are really important and crucial to have a dialogue and to sort of further the practice of the arts, because the arts are so integral to how civilizations evolve. I think I thought that was something I wanted to prioritize in doing what I do with my team. So yeah, I think that's the perspective I'm coming from.
And it's fascinating. You're involved in all these disparate areas. You're an artist, an institutional leader. You're also an entrepreneur. And I wanted to get into a bit of the other projects that you're doing these days. You spent time as a student at Ashesi and then went back. And I noticed you had done this project surrounding e-waste there, which now has become a bigger business for you. But can you tell us a bit about your time in Ashesi, the project that had to do with e-waste, and then we'll get to some of what you're working on now.
At Ashesi University, we were compelled to, you know, there was a course called leadership. You were meant to fulfill a prerequisite amount of 40 hours of community service as part of that course. And so for me, I thought to myself, you know, well, you have what has been dubbed one of Africa's largest electronic waste dump sites in Ghana. And I didn't just want to do a project for the sake of doing a project. I wanted to do something that really had some application to my own life and that of, at least in the context of environmental degradation. because that's something that we have an issue with in Ghana. So I collaborated with the World Bank's Climate Innovation Center and the Ford Foundation, galvanized a team of students in the spirit of volunteerism, and sort of found ways to upcycle electronic waste to do some ethnographic research and to vocationally train slum dwellers at Bobloshi, which was the dump site. That's what it was called. And to really try and empower them to create value-added products from the waste, as opposed to simply burning the scrap and the debris at the dump site. And that unfortunately released harmful carcinogens and toxins into the atmosphere, because that was sort of the informal sector capacity in which they were doing open air burning to salvage precious metals like copper. And obviously you also know that we have industrial gold and electronic waste. So all that was happening. It just became a really big part of my formative years in uni. I really have to thank the photographer who won the Greenpeace Prize, I think back in 2016, if I'm not mistaken, Fabrice Monterio, because he came to Ashesi to ask for volunteers to help in the initial project that took me to the dump site. And I volunteered, and that was how I first discovered it as a Ghanaian myself. It was quite special. And I think for me, it's definitely that experience during my undergraduate program at the university really informed my mindset about creating value and about just really being a pragmatist in, you know, in how one does execute things. And, you know, yeah.
And then you actually went up starting an initiative, an e-waste company that you're doing now.
Exactly. Yes. It started by upcycling and training electronic waste. And then during COVID, because we had issues with safety when it came to visiting really exposed areas, we've just run it as a research initiative that just continues to quietly, you know, conduct and try and derive new data analytics and studies around the activities in the e-waste dump site. And so that's how we pivoted. But yeah, that also is something that's sort of going to be a perennial project that I continuously pursue. But it definitely doesn't take as much time as my involvement with contemporary art does.
It's so interesting in this conversation. We're talking a bit about the art that you're making and the institutions that you're creating, but also how you have this way of doing social entrepreneurship and touching many things you do and not siloed in one place, which is a very contemporary idea. So just to stay on e-waste for a moment, because you've spent so much time with it, and this is really where kind of culture on the art side and nature collide, what are the biggest challenges that we need to overcome when it comes to e-waste? Because I think specifically outside of Africa, people aren't as aware of the fact that companies in the West have gone into Africa, extracted all of this material to make the stuff, and then they just kind of dump it back there.
Yeah, it's like an open secret.
Yeah, so let's talk about it for a second to share with our audience.
I mean, to touch on it, I think let's start with the iPhone I'm using to speak with you on, you know, with my silicon screen before me. Most of these devices are created with something called planned obsolescence. So they're not built to last in the way that, you know, we would have them. So I love Apple as much as the next guy. I use an iPhone and I'm wearing AirPods, all the good stuff. You know, those companies are partially complicit through the model of planned obsolescence, which is integral to, you know, certain profit margins. You know, those are the idea of building something so that it is obsolete within a period of time and not for it to last is a contributing factor of why we have waste in the first place. Additionally, I think spreading the blame evenly, I think that there's a sense of replace and not repair that people have when it comes to the use of their electronic devices. And I think in many ways, this culture of mass consumerism and a insatiable appetite for the new is something that, well, you know, human beings have contributed to over decades. Just without getting too scientific, you know, about the realities, I think these factors do present what I would describe as a challenge when it comes to combating the issue of electronic waste. And yeah, it's a very complicated problem. I do appreciate that, but you know, nonetheless, it is a problem.
As a final note on that, how responsible do you think the companies that have created this waste across the board are to solving the problem? And have you thought about engaging these companies and helping the initiatives that you're doing?
I think what we need to understand is that the chain of electronic waste is such a complex, long value chain before it gets to the tons and tons of legally and illegally dumped material. I think companies know that they are complicit and limited to say that there is a lot of advocative work and awareness created around it. I think companies know about the involvement. I just think that it doesn't seem to be a priority in that regard. Mm. Efforts to make that change needs to be a pull factor from them as opposed to a push factor from people like me who have been involved in advocative work to transform the issue. But, you know, as far as like SDG goals, one of the major SDG goals is collaboration to achieve the goals, right? And so I think it does need to come from the main proponents of sort of creating this waste as opposed to the people on the receiving end. That's definitely a wider discussion for sure.
And back to art. This year saw one of the first Ghana pavilions at the Venice Biennale. It's now Ghana has its sort of tent pole at this global event. And there are contemporary Ghanaian artists such as Ibrahim Mahama and Amoako Boafo who have gained massive global recognition in recent years. How do you view the work you're doing in this context? You know, what are your ambitions for the cultural scene of Accra, of Ghana, and just in terms of raising greater awareness of Ghanaian art and culture?
My views are that I'm really excited for the sustained longevity that I see within the growing interest in African contemporary art. And I'm really passionate about institutional thinking. One reason why I deeply respect Ibrahim Mahama, who's a dear friend of mine, is that he's, you know, created these two great institutions, the SCCA in Tamale and the Red Clay Studios, which are in the north of Ghana, these museum quality cultural spaces that he's built from repurposed silos and sites. I think that beyond commercialism, beyond auction prices, beyond sort of the frenzy of interest, which is sometimes etched in frivolity, I think it's important to, for me, especially and for my team, to keep in perspective the need for sustained longevity in, you know, within the careers of the artists that we support and within the global discussion around African contemporary art, beyond just having a moment or beyond just having a sensationalized appearance onto the global slipstream. So it's kind of been interesting to see the growth that the role that the residency has played in really like nurturing careers time and time again. But I think that for me, yeah, I'm very proud that artists get to become breadwinners for their families and build livelihoods around their practice. I think that's very important. But I'm more passionate about the curatorial side of things where we partner meaningfully with institutions to really push forward the critical discourse around the work. You know, I'm planning a partnership with the Stanley Museum of Art, which involves an exchange program from artists from the Nodal Residency to be able to engage with work at the Stanley Museum in Iowa and the School of Art at the Iowa University. I was actually recently given a private tour of their new building. I've been to Casawabi in Mexico, where my dear friend and artist Bosco Sodi wants to have artists from Nodal run an exchange program with artists from Mexico and come to Mexico to really deepen the artistic process. I think just having more meaningful discussions with institutions and having that critical discourse around the work for me is what is important beyond just the frenzy and the interest, which fluctuates and evolves over time.
We've covered a lot of territory in this conversation, and your work, as I'm sure clear to listeners, is vast, whether that's your paintings and your woven tapestry work or the institution building you're doing, the e-waste project. Going back even further, the music you've created, what do you hope people take away from all that you do? And also, what are your sort of hopes as you look toward the future in terms of creating this longevity that you're speaking about?
It's a good question. I think that for me, I'm very happy to have found a focus being an institutional leader at a very critical time in African contemporary art history. And I'm proud of the nuanced journey I've been through to experience many things. I mean, I just turned 26. All my 30 employees would be the first to admit that beyond being the youngest member of the team, I'm probably one of the most driven and have a critical attention to just really doing our best in the long-term responsibility we have as an institution. My hope and the objective or the major KPI of my success is that the institution outlives me and my team. That is the point. What I hope people take away from this is that no matter how young you are, I think it's important to keep your goals and objectives in the service of something bigger than yourself in perspective. Another takeaway that I hope people have as far as discussions around mental health is that I was diagnosed manic depressive at the age of 16 and only, I think, quit self-harming about 4.5, 5 years ago. And I will always be manic depressive, but I think what I want people to understand is that to really know that you are entirely capable of achieving what you want to achieve, even in the stigmatized context of mental health, I think it's important to normalize discussions around depression and suicide and the adversities we go through when it comes to just navigating life. Just for people to understand that it is possible to achieve your goals despite the limitations or the perceived limitations of suffering from bipolar disorder or any sort of mental health trauma. So yeah, I think that's another thing I hope people take away. And also to try, especially when you're young, to try as much as you can to understand what you don't want out of life and what you don't want to do. I think it's much more important to know what you don't want, for sure. And I think that will definitely guide your path as far as what you choose to do. I'm very fortunate that I work with a team of passionate people in the service of others. And I think it's a very special feeling. And I hope other people get to experience that for themselves. So those are hopefully the takeaways I have for your audience. And I hope that my monologue has helped in some regard anyone reach any sort of epiphany.
Joseph, thank you so much for your time today and look forward to following all that you're building in Ghana and beyond.
Likewise, thank you very much and wishing you all a pleasant rest of the day as well.
Thanks to our episode sponsor, the Japanese luxury timepiece manufacturer Grand Seiko, which raises the pure essentials of watchmaking to the level of art. You can learn more about the company at www.grand-seiko.com. And thanks for listening. To hear more episodes of At a Distance, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. To sign up for our weekly newsletter, Exploring the Five Senses, head to our website at www.slowdown.tv. This episode was produced by Ramon Broza, Emily Jang, and Johnny Simon.